Hello, and welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharakana. We invite you to join us on Thursdays at 8 p.m. for an engaging exchange with us and our special guest as we cover various topics regarding history, genealogy, and your personal family history stories. Hello, I'm Janice Gilliard.
And I'm Sharakana Feliciano. Welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharakana. Thank you for joining us, and be sure to check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Today, we are joined by our guest, Maya Davis.
Maya Davis is currently the new director at the Riverdale House Museum. Maya was also a research archivist and legislative liaison at the Maryland State Archives. During her time at the archives, she consulted on statewide projects that document, interpret, and preserve African-American history and culture, and facilitated discussions on state legislation and contemplated legislation. Some of Maya's recent projects include the installation of the Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman statues at the Maryland State House, the Annapolis Port Marker Project, and the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad National Historical Park and Visitor Center.
Maya also serves as a commissioner on the Maryland Lynching Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the Maryland Commission on African American History and Culture, and is a board member of the Prince George's County Historical Society. Previously, Maya served as the interim director of the Banneker Douglas Museum and the Maryland Commission on African American History and Culture, staff at the City Museum of Washington, D.C., and vice chair of the Annapolis 1864 Commission to commemorate the emancipation of slavery in Maryland. A native Washingtonian, Maya is a graduate of Howard University and the George Washington University, where she obtained degrees in history and museum studies. Welcome to Speak On It, Maya Davis.
Thank you so much for having me, Sharakana and Janice. I'm so happy to be here to speak on it. And I got to get a shout out to my bisons at Howard.
Hey.
So Maya, historian, archivist, activist, museum director are just some of the positions you've held. You also obtained degrees in history and museum studies from Howard and George Washington Universities. Please share with us what led you to this course of study and the direction of your professional career, basically your why.
Oh my goodness, Janice. That's usually my favorite question that I get from people whenever I'm interviewed. And it's because at the heart and soul of everything I do, genealogy has driven me to this. From small, like being a child, I can remember like just enjoying being around adults, grown people, listening to them talk and share stories about our family history. And I just like retained it. It was almost like I was like prepping to be the next griot in my family and just listen to all those stories. And my grandmother, they were just so funny telling the stories of their childhood, talking about their great grandmothers, their grandmothers. And I'm fortunate that I've had people that live a long time. My great grandmother, my maternal great grandmother lived to be in her 90s, and her oldest sister lived to be 104. So wow. I've always been blessed to kind of have that long generational span of history around me. And I also recognize that at a young age that I really just enjoyed museum spaces, and in particular history museums, and just going and like taking in the information. So I think that's where it all began, but just being around history. You know, when you're young and you grew up and you're going to a Black home and you're looking at the coffee table and the first things you see on the table are like a Bible and a copy of Roots. And I can remember that because like today I'm talking to you, I'm in my house, but the house that I'm in was my great grandmother's house. And so to kind of have that connection to this home and that history, that common thread, you know, not only was it my great grandmother's house, when my grandfather married my grandmother, they had their first two kids in this house. When my great grandmother passed, she left this house to my mom, who was the only one of her siblings that had children at the time. So, you know, there's so much meaning and connection. And I feel like there's so many moments in my life that have kind of prepared me to step out on faith and take in history. It's just always been a great interest.
That's powerful. I envy you in a good way, not in a negative way. I wish that that had been my experience. You know, the struggle has been, my genealogy struggle has been real. Yours, yes. To me, it's like it was a gift that was presented to you early on. So that's a blessing. Real quick before we move on, living in a home that your family, like that's been in your family for a while. Yeah. Do you ever have this spiritual connection at all?
I do have a spiritual connection to this home. Like I see so many commonalities between me and my great grandmother. Like she was a single mom, essentially. I was a single mom. She only had one child. I have one child. Just we had so much in common, and I really had an affinity for like the Harlem Renaissance, and I just couldn't understand why. And like when my grandmother finally turned over her papers to me, and the guy that I knew is my great grandfather, who was really the adopted father of my grandfather, he was a drummer for Billie Holiday. And I was just like, wow. Like it knocked my socks off. His name was George Jones. And he had not only played with Billie Holiday, he had played with Ovie Alston, who was a local big band leader from Washington, D.C.
Wow.
And I was told by my grandfather's half sister that it was my great grandmother who introduced him to Count Basie, which allowed him to kind of get into being connected with people like that. Yeah. And I'm just
gonna rock this history thing all the way out. Wow.
All the way out. So, you know, it's so many interesting stories. And, you know, we all try to kind of, I think we look at a lot of people and they really want to be connected. It's like, oh, I'm connected to George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. And it's like your own simple family history is interesting enough.
I love that you said that. That is so true. That is so yeah. true. And that's something I think about too every Black History Month, because it's like it is important to, you know, honor the greats for sure, and those that have made, you know, these achievements and strides. You know, we should know about them, but not at the expense of, you know, our own personal stories and family history. There's so much there. There's so much to learn there. And just the everyday people.
Yes, and they're so interesting in their own right. I think that's kind of how I try to model my career, is we have these bigger stories that are looming large, but let's fill in the gaps with the lesser known voices. That's always my goal.
Absolutely.
That's a book title, The Lesser Known Voices. Thank you.
Oh. Yeah.
So Maya, we read an article that discussed some of your past projects, like the installation of the Frederick Douglass House and the Harriet Tubman statue at the Maryland State House and the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad National Park and Visitor Center. How involved were you with each project, and did the process have an impact on you?
Yes, I was so fortunate to be in a space where I was involved from the ground up with both projects. Awesome. Let me first give you a caveat and just say that during my time at the Maryland State Archives, you know, I'm going to transition from the Roots book on the coffee table to my supervisor there was Chris Haley, the nephew of Alex Haley. His father was Alex Haley's youngest brother. And so going in with that pressure, you know, it's just like, oh my God, I can't believe that this book that I not only read, but looked at my whole life, I'm now connected with someone who's like a voice for that family. So Chris has always been so great at sharing the stage. And it was just a delight to have a supervisor that took me along for the ride and didn't find me to be like opposing or someone who was gonna, you know, kill his light or dim his light. Mm-hmm. He took me along and was really a mentor to me and allowed me to come in those spaces and recognize that I really had a passion for taking history and not necessarily just putting it in the classroom or putting it online, but like putting it out in a creative way. So I worked on the Harriet Tubman Visitor Center as a part of their interpretive team, as well as Chris, from the ground up. So like when they started having community meetings, which some were very great, some got very testy, you know, a decision really had to be made on where this state park was going to go. You know, there's a contingent of Harriet Tubman descendants and supporters in Cambridge, Maryland, but there's also ownership in Auburn, New York, where she settled the rest of her life. So they have a park home there. And so they had a huge buy-in, and it got really testy a couple times, but the decision was ultimately made to have it in the place where she was born. And so that we can kind of have that place to memorialize her life, because honestly, we really had not done our due diligence as a state to recognize people like Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass, who are key figures in the 19th century and really deserve the honor. So we took that work, and it was a long labor of love, like over 10 years that we worked on that project. You know, people, like, the building shows up in maybe like 2 years time, and people think, oh, it just shows up. But no, it's a long period of time to kind of get something like that off the ground. And it was a partnership between the Maryland State Archives, where I worked, the Maryland Department of Natural Resources, the Maryland Office of Tourism, and the National Park Service, which is not a common partnership that you see at different parks. Usually the National Park Service have their parks and they belong to the National Park Service. So we're now looking at sharing a space and telling the story of Harriet Tubman from a local perspective and a national perspective.
Interesting.
So it really is, it was a labor of love, and I've met some of the greatest people that I've ever known in my life. One biographer, Kate Larson, who had done the book on Harriet Tubman, Kate Clifford Larson, she's been at the table. Other scholars like Lois Horton, I know Brian Joyner from National Park Service, just really great people who really recognize that if you come together for a common goal and you mm-hmm. just work together, get it done is really important. So we were really happy to see that work take off and come to fruition. We went through a couple of iterations of designers. Like, you know, you got to start over sometime in the midst of the process. Like, things don't always go the way you expect them to. But in the end, it came out to be a product that I think we were all happy about. And then in regards to the statues at the State House, that really came about. I don't even like to take first credit for that, because people have been advocating for getting Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass recognized in the state for years, long before I even worked at the Maryland State Archives. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Banneker Douglass Museum in Annapolis, but it came out of the African-American Commission for the State, which was established in 1969 and had been, you know, advocating for preserving the state's African-American history. And then, of course, at the forefront of that is Benjamin Banneker, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman. So that work carried forth into what we were able to do. But, you know, there came a time when the Maryland legislature made an appropriation for the creation and installation of the Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass statues. And the Maryland State Archives is the repository for the state-owned art collection. And we do have, we had a chief curator and a curatorial team, which we, the legacy of slavery, Chris and myself, we kind of partner with them internally on statewide projects, because it, we represented the African-American voice. And so we had to be at the table. And so with that work, it was so exciting because we chose the company Studio Ice, which has done statue and sculpture work for different museums across the country, including the Smithsonian. So we did that work, and it allowed me to travel back and forth to New York to actually go in and look at their process. They hired actors to like recite lines and take photographs so that we can decide a pose, which I don't think a lot of people get to do when they're choosing statues, but it was a really good process for me. It was really exciting.
That is cool.
Yeah, and like, you know, we print out all these images of Frederick Douglass. We had to determine a certain age that we were looking at. The space that they're in the State House is the old House of Delegates chamber. And it's the space where they made the decision to emancipate slaves. They voted on that act in that room. So if we're looking at that time period, you know, that's November the 1st, 1864. We wanted to capture Harriet Tubman and Frederick at that time period. And knowing, you know, what we had in terms of imagery, we had images of Frederick Douglass from 1864 that we could choose from. Harriet Tubman, everything was around those. So the closest that we could get is the newest image that was acquired jointly by the Library of Congress and the National Museum of African American History and Culture that we now see all over the place because we're so excited to see a young Harriet Tubman. So that's what we use. And we really had a special moment because Tubman, unlike Douglass, didn't really have direct descendants. She had like adjacent descendants, like her siblings' children. There's descendants that survive now. But Douglas has direct descendants. And so his one great-great-grandson, Kenneth Morris, reached out to us because he likes to be hands-on with the Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives, which he's the head of, and being involved. And at the time that he came to the table, I'm so embarrassed to say, we had not contacted him and we were already starting the process. And it's like, wow, what can we do to bring him in? And I don't even want to take credit for it. One of my colleagues said, well, let's have him go up to Studio Ice and see what's going on. And right. the decision was made to cast his hands as the hands of Frederick Douglass.
Wow.
That is
so
beautiful.
So symbolic. Yes, I was so happy that they came to think of that option because it really kept him at the table. And I think he was happy and satisfied because apparently he's worked on a couple of different projects and he uses a different sculptor. And I was just like, oh no, he's gonna be mad when he finds out we're not using his sculptor because we are too far in the process. But he was really so supportive throughout the whole process. And when we opened, he actually was one of our speakers at that event. So I'm so happy to connect. Yeah.
Well, you know what? It's interesting to hear the back part of it.
Yeah.
Because you go to a museum, you know, you look at it, and I'm being very honest, I don't think of everything that goes into it. So thank you for, you know, and I'm sure our listeners will be able to appreciate that as well. All of the work that goes into the final product, what you see.
Yes.
It does. And then, you know, the timing, it realistically could have taken a lot longer, but we were up against a time crunch. When that appropriation went through, Mike Miller and Mike Bush were still at the heads of the Maryland legislature. In between that time, Mike Bush passed away. Oh, and Mike Miller was left by himself, you know, battling cancer and knowing that he would imminently pass away. And he really stayed on us, like, get these statues done. And I think that he knew that his time was limited. And so it became, honestly, a thing where we're looking at, like, trying to get this done so he can be there to, you know, he's like the president of the Senate and Speaker of the House. We got to have these people here. So we really were able to kind of speed up that process. But it involved, like, shoring up the floors, the statues, making sure that it could support the weight of the statues going in. Like, they're heavy statues. And this is an old historic business building that has an easement on it. It takes a lot of behind the scenes work. And so our team collectively worked to do that.
So, Maya, currently you are the executive director of the Riverdale House Museum. One of your projects included tracing the genealogy of enslaved people who lived on the site, in some cases to current Prince George's County residents. Updating the museum's exhibits to reflect all of the people that lived in and worked on the property and working with Indigenous people to include their narratives as well. Please share with our listeners a little about this project and the current status.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for highlighting that work. I'm truly excited. I will first start by saying that one of the things that I recognize with historic house museums of the time period, 19th century, 18th, 19th century historic house museums, is that they have an inherent problem of being a one-sided narrative in the histories that they were telling, and have been for a long time. And largely because you have not had people of color at the table to help out with that content, whether that be in a volunteer capacity or staffing capacity. So it's always been my goal, and that's how I frame my career, is that I enter into spaces and help them balance their history. So, you know, when we did the State House, Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman, they're the first statuary in the State House of people of color in the state. You know, Frederick Douglass's portrait, which is in Government House, as another project that we kind of worked on. It was the first prominent portrait of an African-American individual in Government House. So every time I come to the table, I'm thinking, what is missing from this story? So coming to Riversdale, I've visited in the past, and I will say here up front, the story of Adam Francis Plummer, who was enslaved there, had been researched long before I got there. They had been interpreting his life there. But I always wondered who else was here. Adam could not have been able to maintain a house of this size on what was 749 and a quarter acres of land by himself. Who else is helping make this thrive? Who built this? Who served here? Who cleaned here? Who took care of the children? Because I'd have a great understanding. I won't even say a general understanding, a great understanding of how slavery operated in the state of Maryland. And Maryland is one of those states that I think kind of has gotten a pass for its role in terms of enslavement of people and social injustices in its history. So going there, that was my goal. And I went in and from the beginning, I said, you know, we start this history from a colonial mindset. We have to remember that there were people who were here long before the Europeans arrived on their cruise ships, their luxury cruise ships, their servants, and, you know, deemed this to be Maryland and Prince George's County, where our house is. And so I always wanted to look at how do we bring the Native American story into the table. And understanding that I've had frustrations over the years at African-Americans not being at the table to tell African-American history, I didn't want to take on that work without bringing members of Indigenous tribes in Maryland to the table. So having worked with the African-American Commission, I knew there were seven other state ethnic commissions, one of them being the Maryland Commission on Indian Affairs, who's led by Keith Colston, who put me in touch with some local Piscataway representatives, Rico Newman and Peter Brooks. And they have been such a great resource to me and putting me in touch with the right people, reviewing some of the things that we're trying to do at our site. Like, we have a garden outside, which people absolutely love. It's an interpretive garden that wasn't interpreting anything. And I'm sure it like probably bothers my staff when I say that, because I like drill that in. I'm like, why are we calling it interpretive garden? There's no signage out here. And there still isn't signage out there. We're trying to wait for stakes to come out so we can start putting signage out. But, you know, we have a section of our garden that we're now designating as a Native American garden. And making sure that we give honor to this land in Prince George's County once belonging to the Piscataway and the Anacostans who came before them, and making sure that we do our due diligence there. And then moving that work forward to include the African-American experience. And it's not, you know, I have to constantly explain to people, especially people who have been longtime stakeholders, we're not erasing the history of the Calverts, but the fact of the matter is that we have so much information on them. We just now have to add to and enhance that story by making sure that we uplift the voices of everyone else. So
there's a whole county named after the Calverts. So
a whole county and so many other things. So, you know, that would be impossible to undo. And they're the proprietors of our state. That legacy would never go away. But now we need to tell the story of the individuals who have been silenced by neglect in records. You know, the intentional neglect. The only time that you would see enslaved people were through tax assessments, censuses, but, you know, to kind of highlight the ownership of individuals like the Calverts, and making sure that we give voice to people who didn't have an option to have a voice during that time. Fortunately for us, we have Adam Francis Plummer, who kept the diary, and how he kept that under wraps to survive so that we can see it all these many years later is just amazing to me. So, you know, starting there, that's my starting point at Riversdale, is we have the diary of Adam Francis Plummer, which is owned by the Anacostia Community Museum, which had it up and digitized for people to see. It's such a unique find to find a slave diary that survived from that time period, which is totally a separate thing from like slave narratives.
Right.
You know, it is like a firsthand account, and he started keeping that from the day that he got married, which I think is just so telling about his personality. And that he can read
them. Share with us for sure the journey, because that's such a great find.
So before you move on, Maya, real quick. Mm-hmm. So like, I'm listening to you and I appreciate everything that you're saying, but my question to piggyback off of the initial question was, what was your approach though? Because was it, excuse me, I have questions, or what about all of this over here? Like, So did you have to, did you ask questions or did you, was your approach, excuse me, I'm the new executive director. We need to make some corrections here and all. And so this is how we're moving forward, you know, or, but me, I probably would have been scared. I have questions. Wait a minute, there's a whole lot of questions that I have about why this information is not included. So I'm just curious, what was your approach? Because I'm thinking, do I ask or do I say, okay, so we're going to work together as a team, and this is the direction that we're going to go in, because we're missing a whole lot of information. So I'm curious as to what was your approach to make sure that the other, the folks that were left out, that their story was included and correcting the narrative. So how, what was your approach? I'm just curious about that.
So my approach in going in, I knew before I even got there, and I did a little bit of all, everything that you just laid out. But before I even started, I knew that my vision for Riversdale is that it would at minimum be a place with a balanced narrative. And so I started researching other museums that were starting to do this work. I, again, being a genealogist, I knew that I wanted to bring descendants to the table. And so I had all of those things. And my approach was that I worked with my former supervisor, Omar Eaton Martinez, who's now at the National Trust for Historic Preservation. I knew that I had the support of Omar. And the only person that I really needed to ask questions and permission from was Omar.
Oh, so you went in with some power. Okay, I got you. I understand.
Yeah, so, you know, I felt like I was empowered under his leadership. And I will say, like, it got tough at times. You know, I am the first person of color to hold this position and work at the site. So I'm going into a community that has, you know, embraced the interpretation that they currently had. And I knew that I was going to have to build buy-in. But I think they also knew that they were going to need to change because the community has changed so much over time. And we really are behind on addressing the needs of the community. So when I got to Riversdale, we were just about to start. They had already applied for a MAP assessment, which is a museum assessment program to look at community and audience engagement. So I was able to go along for the ride. And it was a learning lesson for me because, you know, growing up in this area, Prince George's County and Washington, D.C. has largely been African-American, predominantly African-American during my lifetime. Now a new Spanish-speaking community here with people from all over. And it's like, well, how do we, you know, make this matter for our brown brothers and sisters as well? Why should they find this important? So that's one aspect of it, is considering what that looks like, and then also embracing some of the interests of my team. Like, they have different interests. You know, I have a collections manager, I have an assistant director, I have a gardener, we have a volunteer coordinator. So, you know, just one meeting with people one-on-one to find out not only what their work interests were, but who they were at their core. Like, what do they enjoy outside of work? So that has been my tactic in working this through, but then also educating the team along the way on what the best practices have become in museums in terms of balancing history, and then also what the benefits will be. So we have been able to form a descendant network committee that we're just getting off the ground and reaching out to different descendants. And it's really been interesting because we've been contacted by people from California, both Calvert descendants and Plummer descendants. We're hoping to get more descendants from other families soon. But Plummer family descendants had been at the table before, but there are new family members who hadn't been a part of the discussion. So that's been really helpful. So I think when you have that support from people in the descendants group, we've also had a focus group as well of scholars from different backgrounds who are looking at enslavement. Dr. Cheryl LaRoche, who has done research at Hampton Plantation in Baltimore County, Maryland, and also is an archaeologist, anthropologist at University of Maryland. And we are the Founders House. Like, that's one of the things that's never really talked about. We are the Founders House for the University of Maryland. Charles Benedict Calvert, who was the third proprietor and slaveholder at Riversdale, was the person who sold the land that was once part of Riversdale to form the Maryland Agricultural College. So we have such a deeply embedded history, and we have a lot of catching up to do. And so we're at a juncture where, you know, we're now part of the national conversation as a part of this work.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And going really quickly back to the story of the diary, that diary was actually thought to be lost. Yes. So this discovery is such a dream come true. So share a little bit more about the journey, yes. Some of his journey that you found in the diary.
Oh my goodness. So one, I think one of the greatest things to know is that only a small portion of the diary survives. Apparently it was over 200 pages and like what survives now is like 48 pages or so, give or take. And so we only have a little bit to go over, but I mean, it allowed us to see when people that he was related to or friends with were married, when they died, when they gave birth, the building out of his own family. And, you know, it's such a unique volume because it shows that the enslaved community at Riversdale had a very close relationship with the enslaved community at another enslaved plantation called Three Sisters, which no longer stands, but was in Cheverly, Maryland. And I'm just like, wow, this is really a unique situation of seeing how people, you know, interact during the 19th century. And it's a firsthand account, and it's not from the perspective of the slaveholder. You know, you want to kind of get, you know, I can't have anyone else speak for me. Like, no one could tell you Maya's story, you know, from their perspective. They can tell you what they think of me, but they can't tell you my story. So having that diary, you know, Adam Francis Plummer had been owned by the Calvert family when George Calvert married Rosalie Steer, who actually owned Riversdale. That's important to say, is that that home was owned by a woman. Rosalie Steer inherited that house from her father, Henri Steer, who was a Belgian aristocrat who had come here during the French Revolution under the Reign of Terror with Napoleon. And he lived at the William Pega House in Annapolis. He rented that and then came out to Prince George's County and decided to establish his home in Prince George's County at Riversdale. So after a couple of years, he found out it was safe to go back to Belgium and, you know, not called Belgium at that time, but left the home to his daughter and like empowered her. They had a totally different mindset than people in America. Like, women couldn't really own property in America during that time period. And she was a unique situation. So when she married George Calvert, he also had other properties. And that's a formation of a larger enslaved community because you're bringing your own set of enslaved individuals to the table. You know, they were not slaveholders prior to moving to Maryland, coming from Belgium. But they adjusted quickly because they were able to purchase at least 14.
Right.
And, you know, that population ended up coming to Riversdale. And then George Calvert comes with his enslaved community, one of which is Adam Francis Plummer, who comes to Riversdale when he's 10 years old. And he comes not just by himself. He comes with his two brothers, Henry and Elias, which I just think is just so awesome to know. Because, you know, often we learn about separation in which they were separated from their parents, but you know, at least they had each other for a period of time before they were later on separated. But it's just really unique because Adam held so many jobs, and I hate to use the term, I'm so particular about terms when it comes to slaveholder and enslaved relationships. Like, you know, when I first got there, you know, someone told me, you know, Charles Benedict Calvert was so fond of Adam, and it's just like,
yeah, that's weird.
He owned him.
He owned him.
Right.
And so, you know, and part of that is because not just Adam Francis Plummer wrote about his experience, his daughter Nellie continued his diary and then published her own book, Out of the Depths or Triumphs of the Cross. And in those writings, like, she kind of indicates that he was like a favorite enslaved person. But, you know, the mindset of people who are the next generation out of slavery is very different than how we see things in 2022. We realize the vulnerabilities of the time and how you're conditioned to think.
Yeah.
But Adam and Charles Benedict Calvert actually did grow up together and likely grew up as peers before they were separated into a slaveholder, enslaved individual. biological relationship, and which is the story of many, you know, slaveholding children who grow up to be slaveholders. You know, you start off as peers and playmates, and then eventually you're separated so that we can establish that you're an enslaved individual and I am your slaveholder. And so establishing that hierarchy,
right,
that comes with that. So it's just really a great story of Adam Francis Plummer, who was a cobbler. He worked in the garden. He had his own plot that he grew his own vegetables for, cooking his own meals and things like that. He just really is amazing. But I mean, the fact that he knew how to read and write, and he actually had taught other people how to read and write, I think is one of his strongest suits, and just an understanding for the necessity of being educated during the 19th century under that system of slavery. I just think he's just so remarkable. And the fact that he was able to live to tell that story and live through emancipation too, because, you know, slavery is, it's labor, and it's tough labor, and it's really hard to survive the pandemics and epidemics of the time, health-wise. We do know that there was, I believe it was yellow fever or something that swept through the family. And the Calvers themselves, they were the parents of 9 children. I believe at least 4 of those children had died over time for some cause or reason. And, you know, we see a lot of loss, but there's a lot of survival in that story. And I think Adam Francis Plummer is one of the greatest surviving stories that we have to tell at Riversdale.
That is amazing. In one article, you noted that what museum visitors want to know the most is the truth. Though that truth depends on whose perspective you're telling it from, the heart and soul of this work is that we are giving individual voice to the people who lived here during the 19th century, and that would include the Calverts and the enslaved population. Especially because it is a site of trauma. We have to at least own that. But then in also making a way to celebrate the fact that these people overcame the institution of slavery, and many of them lived beyond emancipation here in Maryland and have thrived and survived such a traumatic experience. And reflecting on your comments, what has your experience been in dealing with visitors to the museum?
You know, it has been a mix of experiences, because, you know, people are people. There have been times when I've had African American visitors come for the first time, and they're like, "Oh, I'm so happy to see you here." Like, you know, they're like, "Okay, so what are we about to get?" You know, and I've had people tell me, you know, they really need to do more to tell the story of the enslaved. I have that. But then on the flip side of that, you know, I have people that have come and said, "Oh, I'm just here for the architecture. I just want to hear about the architecture," which if you tell me that, I can tell you enslaved people built this. And if you really want to learn about architecture, you will.
Oh, you're going to get it. Oh, yeah. You want to know about the architecture? Oh, I got something for you. I'm so sorry.
We're going to have to look at brick making. We're going to have to look at plastering. We're going to have to look at cleaning. All of that, which touches on decision making from the Calvert perspective, but actual making and doing from the enslaved perspective. So, you know, it's a mix. I think the hardest adjustments, of course, are the people that have been there the longest. And, you know, docenting as a volunteer opportunity has been one of those fields, is a position of luxury historically, where people who had the luxury of, you know, being retired or never having worked at all are taking this on as a hobby and have been at the table to make the decisions. Well, this is the interpretation that we're going to have. Well, now that's changing. And I think that the demographic of who's coming to Riversdale has greatly changed, but we have to be community centered in everything that we do. And if we're going to be honest about who is community centered, I don't need to try to reach someone in Texas or Tennessee who's never going to come or never mm-hmm. really respect the work that we're trying to do. I want to meet the citizens of Prince George's County and neighboring Northern Virginia and Washington, D.C., because those people have a direct connection to the history of our home,
right?
And homes like it. So that's what I try to keep at the forefront of it. And I know that African Americans nationwide are more engaged in genealogy than they've ever been. And I think we have a responsibility to try to build on accessibility so that we can reconnect with our history in the same way that other ethnic groups have been able to know and inherently walk in proudness of who they are. Like, we can proudly say who we are the more we know about ourselves.
That's right. That's like the historical version of take care of home first. I like that.
Yes.
I would be tempted to say, okay, so you can get the full version and interpretation, or we can give you, you know, we can accommodate you and get a refund, but you're going to get the refund of this year. Okay. So we're going to talk about all of it.
We're not trying to weaponize anything. Like, we're not trying to weaponize it. We're not trying to make anybody feel bad or guilty. We just want to help educate so that we can be better socially to each other. Like, you know, we have a social responsibility of how we interact with each other. And, you know, we backslid a little bit these last couple of years into places that I never thought I would see. You know, you read about the civil rights movement and you learn about the civil rights movement. You didn't know that it was going to be a continuum in your lifetime. So I think that these are the ways that we kind of break down those barriers and connect with people one-on-one, and we build empathy and respect for each other.
Yes.
That's right. So Maya, do you have any upcoming events that you want to share with our listeners? And are you excited? I mean, you sound excited, obviously, about your position to correct the historical narrative.
Yes, I'm super, super, super excited. You know, when I took this job, I started with some really cool people, and I continue to work with people that have been at PG Parks. We have a Black History program headed up by Dr. Dennis Doster and Artura Jackson, who are both amazing scholars and have been doing Black history for PG Parks long before we got to this place where we were doing inclusive interpretation. They are responsible for our Juneteenth Festival, which takes place annually. This year, we had 8,000 people at Watkins Park for Juneteenth. Yes.
I know.
And they are in charge of our Black History Month programming, as well as our Emancipation Day in Maryland, which takes place annually in November. November 1st. So for me, what I have coming up that I'm really excited about is this month, September 16th and 17th, we have an event that we partner with our archaeology office on called Echoes of the Enslaved. And it is an event that involves a panel discussion that we partner with Joe McGill and the Slave Dwelling Project. He will stay overnight at Riversdale. I'm truly excited about that. And he will give us feedback on his thoughts about the enslaved experience. But he's also going to moderate a panel discussion at Riversdale featuring Reverend Jerome Fowler, who is a descendant of Adam Francis Plummer, who's amazing. And then also Tina Wyatt, who is a great grandniece of Harriet Tubman, because in Maryland, we are still celebrating the year of Harriet Tubman. And then our third panelist will be Dr. Joan Gaither, who is a fiber artist who has done like story quilts that are absolutely beautiful. And she actually created the Maryland Emancipation quilt and also another quilt dealing with Maryland slavery. So she will be there to talk about her work connecting with descendant communities across the state. So we're truly excited about that. And then on Saturday, we are going to have a community open house where we have vendors. We are hoping to have members of the African American Historical and Genealogical Society there, the 1856 Project at the University of Maryland, which also is looking at slavery at the university, and various vendors. We'll have cooking demonstrations. We have a kitchen guild at Riversdale that I'm super proud of. They actually do historic demonstrations, and the sad part about their demonstrations is that they can't share food with the public because it's not a food safe kitchen, but we going to have vendors on hand that do have food licensing.
Okay. Because that would have been a tease.
Yeah. But we'll be able to kind of show like the difference between modern cooking and historic cooking and like the length of time that it takes to prepare a meal and all that. Oh my God, like I'm just always blown away. Like it's like a full day. I'm just like, I don't know how enslaved people cooked food every day for a family for three square meals. I'm like so like beside myself every time I go in there and see what it takes. But we're going to be doing that. And the theme of that day will be Black Health and Wellness, which is the national theme of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. And so we're going to have like some mindful and wellness activities, as well as the cooking demonstration. So we're so excited. So we encourage people to definitely come out for both days.
That is awesome.
So
it sounds like a lot of fun.
So what are some parting words of inspiration and tips that you would like to share with our listeners?
Parting words. My words of wisdom, and only because I talked to Janice a couple of times and we just talk about the importance of being at the place where you're meant to be. I believe that wholeheartedly, that I was called to do this work, and my words of wisdom for the public is that if you are called to do something, stand strong and steadfast in that, and don't let anything deter you. Just know that you're meant to be exactly where you are. No one can give it to you and no one can take it away. It's yours, so claim it.
I like that. I like that.
Mm. That is awesome. Thank you so much. Maya, thank you so much for joining us on Speak On It. And can you let our listeners know where they can obtain some more information about Riversdale House Museum and about you?
Yes, we are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can actually Google it. I don't even have the direct link here to give to you. We do have a website. I should pull that up right now because, you know, it's one of those vanity websites. So I got to tell you what the name is. Our website is www.pgparks.com/Riversdale House Museum. And that is a way that you can get in touch with us. And if anyone wants to email me, I can leave my email address as well. I'm maya.davis@pgparks.com.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you so much. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us. And we look forward to sharing with you during our next segment of Speak On It.
Speak On It is a podcast and is immediately available to listen to at your leisure. Thank you.